All right, guys, before we jump in, I want to tell you real quick about the 0 to 100 Elite Mastermind. This is our own high-level group for serious real estate investors looking to scale fast. Inside, we share deals, strategies, and we build real relationships all to grow our cash flow portfolios. And you know what? Most members actually add 10-plus units in their first year. Plus, you'll get exclusive access to our podcast guests for direct Q&A. If you're chasing time freedom through real estate, check it out at 0to100tribe.com. That's Z-E-R-O-T-O, the number 100, tribe.com. Now, enjoy the show.
I wrote a bunch of checks to myself, like rent checks from like fake people. I'd want to feel what it was like to get mailbox money.
Being on some chips, we go 0 to 100 real quick.
Welcome to the 0 to 100 podcast. I'm Travis Dillard, and we are all about scaling a cash flow real estate portfolio from 0 to over 100 units and achieving your retirement number one, or R1. That's where passive income from real estate replaces your day job and gives you complete time freedom, which is the new currency of the rich.
I'm Mitchell Lehman, and I'm thrilled to have you on board. With our combined real estate holdings valued over $100 million, learn from us and others who achieve time freedom through cash flow real estate.
This is Gabriel Hamill. Here at 0 to 100, you will not hear us talk about house flipping, spec homes, wholesaling, or land banking. We are only about achieving time freedom through buying and holding cash flow real estate. So remember, if R1 is the destination, real estate is the vehicle, and cash flow is the gas. Now go out there and buy some cash flow real estate.
What is up, everybody? This is Mitchell England. We've got Gabe Hamill and Travis Dillard on the call. So we are going to be interviewing our very own Travis today, which is pretty fun because we get to work with Travis every single day and exchange inappropriate text messages and phone calls and jokes and talk trash and do deals with. And I think you guys should get to know him better. So with that being said, we're going to jump into his life, what he did to scale his portfolio, as well as build his tech company and sell it. Travis, I give Travis a lot of trash, but like Travis is an awesome, awesome dude. Good father, husband, friend, and amazing entrepreneur. And I get to work with him every day. So we're going to dive in and kind of learn his story, unpack it, ask some hard questions. We're going to talk about how, what it's like to be turned away from roller coasters as an adult.
I don't even know what it's about, but it sounds like an amazing story, and I can only anticipate. I'm excited.
It's actually not even a story. I just made it up. So
it's just Mitch insulting me because Mitch is a dick. That's what's happening with Mitch. And he's shorter than me now, by the way. Mitch, you're shorter than I am.
So Travis, yeah, well, that's because you bought your height. Travis got surgery to get leg extensions. That's what you do when you have, I have a house, I have the car, I don't know what to do anymore. Maybe I should just get my legs extended. So that's, anyway, we'll get into that too. But in all seriousness, Travis is an awesome dude. He's built an awesome castle and continues to do so. And I'm honored to do business with him. And yeah, let's dive in. Travis, why don't we start like we always start, way back when, before you did anything in business or real estate, maybe talk about, you know, little tiny Travis, who's going to grow up to be little tiny as well, but
a little wealthier, a little taller.
How'd you get started, man? Tell us about the beginning.
I love that we make fun of each other's heights because we're all just like,
we're all the same size.
Three of us are like really short. Yeah. So, all right, Travis, now that you're done avoiding your childhood, tell us about your childhood. What was Travis as a kid like what was your upbringing, what was your family situation? Let's go there. All right, so little Travis, yes, was very little. I was the little guy in school. I'm from Hood River, which is a small little, back in the day it was like logging and like farming. And so came from, you know, pretty modest means. My mom was a school teacher, my dad worked at a mill. And, me as a kid, I was really inquisitive. Turns out I asked a lot of questions and annoyed the shit out of a lot of people. If I saw a red light on a piece of electronic equipment, I'd have to ask questions. So I learned about the power all the way back to like Bonneville Power Dam. So I was inquisitive, not great at school. And then I eventually, ended up living with my pops, my dad. And, yeah, we,
we were bachelors and lived in a little single wide and up in Parkdale, Oregon, and had a good childhood though, you know? And I, let's see, I counted cans at a supermarket. It's like, you know, when people bring all their pop cans in and it was like chew spit falling all over the place, I have to count them and crush them in the machine. And then I thought that sucked. Picking berries, like anything I could do to make money. And so there was an internship at the local radio station and I became, a local radio DJ, and did like the news and crap like that. And so that was fun. And then I went off to the military like you guys, except Gabe and I, you and I went off right out of, we went in and enlisted out of high school.
Yeah, I joined in high
Mitch
school.
Snobbing was an officer.
Well, yeah, I joined in high school and you were right, just out, right? 18.
Well, I enlisted at 17
okay, so yeah,
when I, before I went into, yeah, the delayed enlistment program, I would join the Air Force and went off to, and I was in combat communications. And then I did 4 years traveling around the world, doing a lot of deployments. I also got, this is back in the day when you had VHS tapes. And so I got my degree that way, watching people lecture and take, yeah, like a midterm and a final that like an E9 or a chief, a higher ranking person would administer, and got out after 4 years. As a combat communications tech with, I had two classes left and to finish up my bachelor's degree, finish those up, put the degree on my wall or on my shelf and never did anything after that. So it's been sitting there collecting dust ever since.
So Travis, you've done a lot of things, but one of the things you do now is you buy mobile home parks. And so is there any connection with having grown up living in a mobile home to now being a mobile home park owner? Like, were you like this, I want to own a whole bunch of parks and have these units in it one day, or had you not connected the dots there yet?
Yeah, no, actually, Gabe, I didn't. I never, my grandparents lived in a mobile home park in Hillsboro, Oregon, and I spent a lot of time with them as a kid. Never thought anything about it. It wasn't until years later when I met Mitch and we were looking, we decided we wanted to go down this journey and start buying up properties. And we were looking at, like everybody else, we were looking at apartment buildings. And then I kept seeing like these mobile home parks come up on LoopNet and they're all like 10 caps. And I was like, this is interesting. I really like the cash flow on these mobile home parks better, a lot better than apartments. And Mitch argued with me and told me I was wrong, which is usually how most things start until he comes around and realizes that I was right.
Wait,
and then collectively
interview.
We became mobile home park owners.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, yes, no, there wasn't, but it is ironic that like, yeah, from, you know, living in the mobile home to mobile home park owner later on in life.
And I didn't know you were a radio DJ, and now you're a world famous podcast host among many other things. So it's like full circle.
Yes. I feel so much power with this microphone now. It's just really going to my head.
He does. He likes to hear his voice. So he's excited about today. But, so Travis, there is a funny, you got to tell maybe that story about radio. We went and looked at a deal the other day in Hood River and he's like, oh no, this is the guy who owns the park and owns a company that you talked a lot of trash about on the radio.
Yeah. Was he didn't recognize me. I don't think he did. Cause I was just a punk ass high school kid. He owned a music company that they sold CDs, and we were looking for sponsors and he wouldn't do it because he thought we were just a bunch of stupid kids, which we were, because it was me and my two friends that we started a radio show. And so we went to the other guy that sold CDs in town, like the only other guy, and he sponsored it. And then we would always promote Colin from River City Records, and we would trash this guy, Zeman's Music. Sorry if he's, I doubt
wasn't
this
that, wasn't that like, don't buy from a company that rhymes with Zeman's Music.
Yeah. It was stupid.
Yeah. That's so good.
Wow.
I love it.
Wow.
All right. So talk about like you go back. I mean, we're bouncing around, but who cares? Go back to like, your bachelor with your dad, you talked about that. You didn't grow up with like a lot of means. I mean, you had what you needed, but it wasn't like you were handed a silver platter. Like, what changed in your mindset to get excited about like business and real estate? Like, what was that moment? And then secondly, like, how did you jump into that? What was your first move into the entrepreneurial world?
It goes back to sort of like, we're talking about this, like, it goes back to a chip on my shoulder. I don't think people realize that you're a have or a have not when you're in like in grade school. Maybe they start realizing in middle school. I didn't even get it. Middle school was just like camping and running around with my friends and having fun and being a country kid. It was in high school you started understanding the has and the have nots. And so I would say sort of what drove me was the fact that I was a have not. And I remember when everybody was getting ready for college, they were like, oh, I'm going to ASU or U of O or, you know, OSU. And where are you going? And I'm like, I lived with my dad. I didn't even take the SAT test. I didn't even understand what grants and scholarships were. And so I immediately thought everybody was just like a little spoiled trust fund baby, and mommy and daddy were putting them through college. And so at that point I vowed to like just crush all of my peers in life. Like I became really competitive, and I didn't know what that meant. I thought it meant getting a college degree. That's why I got my bachelor's degree while I was in 4 years in the military. That's why I started for my first, I didn't know what that meant. I just knew that I wanted to be really, really successful. And that actually drove me through most of my life into my 30s until I almost stroked out. I'm saying that jokingly, but like it was unhealthy. And so I realized I needed to sort of change my why, which we talk about here on the tribe all the time, is like, find a really damn good why as to what, why you get up every day and do this. And my why worked really well for me. It just wasn't healthy. Don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, it does. I mean, so like you have this, you almost like resent people that it's handed to them. And then you're like diving in, going, you're like, you have this resentment or this, whatever you want to call that, that fuel that fuels your why. I mean, that's not the right word, but competitiveness. And then you die, you know, so, but that's not enough to like get you into the business world and get you into real, like what was, you know, talk right. Maybe about like that first, like, oh, maybe this is my direction.
I was an angry, resentful little troll is basically what it comes down to.
That's what I'm hearing. That's, so that hasn't changed, by the way, guys, if you get to know Travis, that's just the same thing.
I'm just an angry little troll. So I went, let's see, I got out of the military, got a good job, you know, back in the day, I was 22, making like $50,000-$60,000 a year in the tech world. That's in 99, like before things started to melt down a little bit with 01. I didn't even know, like my uncle who's a real estate agent goes, just buy real estate. Like, that sounds like something Gabe would say.
I literally was like, that is the exact advice I give to everyone. Just buy some fucking real estate. Like
Simple. Yeah.
Make it cash flow, buy some real estate.
Yeah. And I had a nice little W-2 job, and I thought, oh, I'm just going to go ahead and get this W-2 job. And they've always told me to invest in my 401k. So I'm going to do that. Oh, look at me. I'm so responsible and smart. I'm going to go buy a house. Well, I had the VA loan, so I could go zero down. In 2000, I bought a 714 square foot house that I house hacked, by the way. How the hell do you house hack a 714 square foot house? You wall off half the garage and move your buddies in and then rent the other room out, and zero down at like 8.5% interest. So it's funny, like I'm seeing rates full circle to where they were when I was like getting going. And that was like my first real estate, but I didn't even understand what I was doing. Like I was just like, I can't afford the mortgage. And so I'm going to rent out the rooms. And then yes, over time, I accidentally sort of started my first company. My boss was leaving the company that I was working for and wanted me to go join him. So I was like, oh, that's great. Let's go start a company. You know, my pay got cut in half. I was like, had a car that was running on 3 cylinders and leaking water on my head. I wasn't paying myself. I literally had my credit cards maxed. I didn't know how I was going to eat. Like it got pretty scary starting that first company. And then he became a raging alcoholic, and him and his wife embezzled all the money out of the company. And so I got caught kind of holding the bag like 23 months later, where I was like, I had the IRS knocking at my door. Apparently she didn't pay payroll taxes, the wife, the bookkeeper. So I had to sort of dig myself out of this just giant shithole of that was my first business experience. And I thought that sounded cool. I'm going to own real estate and buy, and start a business. And the real estate turned out to be more than I can afford. So I was barely
How much were you in debt right there when that all went south? Were you in debt as well? Or like, how backwards were you when the business went south and you
had several hundred thousand dollars. And I found this guy that would buy my company, but he turned out to be kind of a snake too. Like, I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. I was 22 years old, 23 years old. And he said, oh, just sign this letter of intent and I will buy your company. I will give you 10% equity in my company, and I will pay off all your debts. And you can come in and be a project manager, which, by the way, like insert gun in mouth being a project manager is not good at that. I'm not an operator, as you know. Like me as a project manager is like,
yeah, it's like the worst, but the wrong person on the wrong seat on the wrong bus. Yeah. So, but I think, what's interesting is people are starting at zero, trying to scale their real estate portfolio. And here you are at negative hundreds of thousands of dollars. Like you're so far the wrong way, but you keep one thing I know about Travis, and I get to work with Travis every single day, is he is resilient. This guy, like, I mean, you could kick him in the teeth 100 times. Like this is, I mean, oh, so maybe, I don't know, just talk about that. Like, where's your, I mean, you glossed over, but like, where's your mindset? You're hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. You try to go into business. You got kicked in the teeth. You still want a good future. You're watching your friends, by the way, make a lot of money and live in nice houses and drive nice cars. And you're just like, I mean, your car barely runs. Didn't you say it ran out a couple cylinders and your window wouldn't roll up or something like that? And I mean,
I had to put a stick. I tore off the door panel and I had to put a stick in the door panel to hold the window up.
So you're living in your garage, by the way, renting out the rest of the house. Like, I mean, this picture for me is like I talk to people who are like, well, you know, I have a good job and I've got a good savings and I don't know how to start in real estate. I'm like, here you are, like, you know, bombing around town in a car, in this little car with hundreds of thousands of debt. How do you get out of that? How do you keep going?
A lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt is what I did. So I went to this guy and I thought he was my savior. Well, I signed my company over. I just signed a letter of intent. This guy was really good at this. Within seconds, my phone numbers were forwarded. My bank accounts were like drained. I lost all my customers and he had no intention of paying off my debt. And he told me that. He goes, you're going to file bankruptcy because I'm actually going to go back on my word. A letter of intent is non-binding, by the way, even with businesses. And so I'm not going to pay your debt off. We got a funny story about this guy, Mitch. Make sure we come full circle.
Oh my gosh,
you're
right.
Anyway, but yeah, so I went to work for the person and I got out of project management because you're just an overhead. They used to line out on them on a profit and loss. And I became a salesperson and then became a really, I guess, like the only way I'm going to get my way out of this is become a really damn good salesperson. So I'd go out, and this is back, we'd sell phone systems to businesses. So I'd go out and collect like a $50,000 deposit check. And I would bring the check in to this guy and be like, I got a $50,000 deposit check for a $100,000 sale. And you'd go to grab it literally. And I'd be like, oh, no, go pay off, you know, make my monthly payments, pay off the IRS. Cause I had a payment plan with the IRS, with distributors, like all these debtors that I had.
That is savage, creditors that Travis. I love it. I mean, that is amazing that you literally dangled the check and said, no. Wait, you're like, I can negotiate too. Go check it out.
Right. But you had to become valuable. Like it comes like I had to be valuable. If I wasn't valuable, he'd tell me to screw off. I saw him do it to people, you know, like, oh, so-and-so's pregnant. Let's just fire her so we don't have to pay like maternity leave.
And, horrible.
And so, yeah, so I had to become a valuable salesperson that drove revenue. And so I just did that. But I say, or you didn't pay me my commission. I mean, this is like the type of company where the guy would issue a paycheck and everybody would grab it and run to the bank. The bank that the business bank was. So in the first, like, you know, 20 employees got their check cash, everybody else bounced. Right. So I would get it ahead of time, make sure I got paid. And then I saved up my money. But lo and behold, like 3 years later, I'd paid off all my debts. They had paid off my debts by me holding them hostage. And I had saved up a decent amount of cash. And then I quit and I went to work for another company, a tech company. And I was driving to Bend, Oregon to sell another phone system to Central Community, or I forget the name of the company. And I'm listening to a CD by Robert Kiyosaki. And that was like the rest of us, right? That was Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And I was like, oh, like I've been trying to do this real estate business thing. I knew I wanted to do it for a reason, but I really didn't know what the hell I was doing. And starting to understand cash flow and are you in the B and the I quadrant versus the self-employed. And like, it was like, not to sound cliche, but man, I got to tell you, like Rich Dad, Poor Dad, that's, I mean, if you want a mindset hack, go listen to that. And that's where I sort of finally figured it out and I was like, oh, that's what I want to do. That's what I need to be doing. And in the meantime, I was sort of dabbling, buying a duplex here. That single family house that I bought, I sold, but then I bought another single family house and I rented it out and I lived in one side of a duplex. I was doing the thing, right? Trying to do the real estate thing. I did some spec houses too. And I actually bought 3 lots. I built one house and I was about ready to build 2 other houses and this thing called 2008 happened. So for those of you in the tribe that like being flippers or speculation builders, oh my God, don't do that, because guess what you can do with bare pieces of land that you're paying interest only payments on every month when the market crashes? fucking nothing. You could do nothing with that land, generate no income except pay a mortgage payment and taxes and insurance. So that was my dabbling in the real estate world. Long story short, I eventually in 2009, and there's another story with the guy, the second guy I went to work with, he kind of ran the business insolvent, and I can get into that story in a second, but I'll pause to see if you have any other questions there.
Yeah. Travis, I had a question. When, you know, a lot of people read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, they listen to Rich Dad, Poor Dad. It's obviously a very impactful book in the real estate investing circles. What was your next, like your next move? You know, that book inspires a lot of people, but I see two types of people going, yeah. You know, sounds nice, but probably not possible for me. And other people take that information and they were like, this is what I needed. I know that that was very impactful for all of us. A lot of the other people in the tribe, a lot of people in real estate investing circles that were in and around, they read that book and they're like, oh my gosh, this is the thing that's going to be life changing. So what, you know, you hear this book and you're like, it was a aha for you, kind of an aha moment. But then what was your next movement? Like, what was the next decision you made based from what you, you know, based on what you heard and what you learned from that book?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I was like, oh, I need to get in the B and the I quadrant. I need to be a business owner and I need to invest in real estate. Okay. How do I do that? I went to my owner of this tiny little, it was like, we had like five employees. And I'm said, I want to be a partner of this company. I want to earn my way into ownership through my sales. And I want to become up to a 49% owner of this company. And so I set up sort of a vesting schedule with him. And then I went out and bought a duplex. So I was like, okay, great. I'm in the B and the I quadrant. And then there's the guy that I did that with, the company, he eventually ran it insolvent. And so I was a sales guy. I was like the guy going out, collecting those deposit checks, shaking your hand. Hey, Gabe, you're making the right decision buying your phone system, through our company. And so, but then what was happening, he was taking that check and that check was supposed to be used to go buy equipment, by tech, you know, the equipment and the software for the company, but he would take it and use it on payroll because he was running robbing Peter, pay to Paul. So he's running an insolvent, cash flow negative company. And eventually those plates stopped spinning where he eventually just went insolvent. So there was like a handful of like eight companies that had given me deposit checks and the money was gone and there's nothing to order. Like we didn't order the software or the hardware and he disappeared. He actually went and filed bankruptcy. He disappeared. He went off into the woods. God knows what happened to this guy. And so I had like these few employees and I had these customers asking me where the hell my deposit check was. Some of them were nonprofits. One was the Portland Rose Festival. Another was like a local nonprofit here in town. And so that's where I had to make up my mind. I'm like, okay, well, do I just run away? I'm just an employee. I actually didn't physically have any employment agreement or any vesting agreement. So I'm like, well, this is all this guy is going to go bankrupt. I can just go get a job somewhere else. And all my friends are like, why would you do this? Why would you take this on? Why would you, you know, just go get a job? And I actually called a competitor of mine and left a message with his assistant and said, hey, he was out of Seattle. I've got a company here. It's turnkey. We've got some support contracts. We've got some customers. All you have to do is fund 50% of these five or eight jobs. And then, you know, and then you can make profit on the support contracts and you get into Portland. And he never called me back. And I found out later he didn't get the message from the agent or from his assistant. So I said, if I don't hear back from this guy, I'm just going to take the company on. I'm going to start my own company, spin up my own LLC. I'm going to hire a couple of the employees. I'm going to cash out my life savings, which was $25,000. I'm going to borrow against my condo that I lived in at the time that was upside down. So I can then go buy the equipment for the first job, get it installed, get paid, then do the second one. But I had no credit lines. I had nothing. And that's sort of how I started my second company.
How'd that little company work out for you?
Great. Started in 2009 and, you know, grew it organically. We grew nationally. I made acquisitions. So I learned how to buy companies, and then exited to private equity. We grew it, exited for, $25 million in, 2020. And then, sold the private equity and then I held on to a much smaller percentage ownership because I sold 80% of it off. And then obviously private equity puts debt on it and there's a lot of puts and takes on the numbers, but that little company sold for, $190 million in October.
Yeah. Not
that
bad.
Started in my living room.
Not bad, Travis. Not bad at all.
Yeah. But also you go back to that resilience, like Travis is there was this quote, I don't know who said it or where I heard it, but it's like 9 out of 10 businesses fail, but what you don't understand is I'm prepared to try 100 times. And it's like, you go try, you know, you go get your teeth kicked in, you keep trying, you will hit you will be successful. And a lot of people, they talk themselves out of it before they even try, before they even fail. And then they, and if they do get to failure, then they're done. But it's like, and then there's that other quote that, it's like success is failure after failure after failure without loss of enthusiasm. And I just picture Travis romping around in his little beat up car, the hundreds of thousands in debts going, I got to figure it out every single day. I'm going to fight and figure it out. And it's the same today working with you, Trav, like, your resilience is like, you never quit. You just continually, even the challenges you've gone through as of late with different properties and different things, which is just part of the game. Like, you never quit, you just fight. And so, anyway, I commend you for that, man. I think that's one of those attributes that's rare, that consistent show up and fight. And you've got that. So I don't know if you guys caught those numbers, 25 the first time, 190 million the second time. I mean, this is what you built is pretty impressive.
Yeah. And Travis, you're a humble guy. And so I think it's important to share that story, because I think a lot of people hear that, you know, there's a lot of people that start in a similar situation and they question, like, am I capable of growing something this big? Am I capable of achieving success, however one might define success? And you're just an amazing example, you know, of that. And you're, you know, there's certain people that I consider just humble badasses. And you're one of those guys. You're humble, but you're a badass, and you take on life with a winning attitude. And, you know, Mitch, maybe if you can't find who those quotes are from, we give those quotes to Travis. Those both sound like something he would say.
We'll dedicate them to him. Yeah, exactly. I love that. Well, Trav, why don't you jump back into the real estate side? I mean, the we talked about your company, we talked about the failure, the failures, and now and then the success, obviously. But like, you talked about real estate, you kind of had that aha after 2008. You speculated before then. It sounds like you were looking at cash flow after that. What? Maybe talk about like the first couple cash flow purchases, and then where your mindset moved over time, and then how you scaled. Cause I think you've got a portfolio of about 700 units, I think, if I'm hitting that number right. But maybe talk about that journey of real estate specifically.
Well, yeah. And before I do that, there's three points I wanted to make on those last comments. Like, one thing is, like, you are who you surround yourself with. And when I was like thinking about taking this company on myself, all of my W-2 friends, and if you're W-2, that's great, no problem, they were like, don't do it. Why would you do that? Why would you put yourself at risk? You've been through so much. Go get a job. You can make $150,000 to $200,000 a year. And I'm glad I didn't listen to them. You know, I'm glad that I followed my gut on that. So that's really important. I always ask yourself, why not you? Like, why not you? Why not sell a company for $190 million? Or why not grow a portfolio of 1,000+ units, or whatever the case is? And the last piece is, and this, I got this from your buddy Gabe. He just wakes up and he's a freaking savage every day. Sometimes you just gotta be a savage. You just gotta put your boots on, your combat boots on every day. And it's work, man. It's not easy. Like, if business and real estate investing was easy, like, everybody would do it. They make it sound easy on social media, the talking heads. But it's not easy. So to answer your question, Mitch, first real estate deals, I think one of my biggest aha moments, I remember some of my first aha moments is don't be speculative, don't buy land, don't buy, flip, you know, don't try and flip houses, don't do, you know, because like when you buy cash flowing real estate, you control that. You control that cash flow. Speculation is like just hope appreciation. Man, I sure hope this thing appreciates. Another aha moment was when I bought that duplex. Like, I lived in one side and then I eventually rented out both sides. And when 08 hit, I had bare land that I was dealing with. I had some single family houses that were rented out that I was dealing with. And there was a lot of risk. If I lost a tenant in the single family house, I was 100% vacant. But on that duplex, it always outperformed. There's always people in there. There's always decent cash flow. And I thought, wow, like, more doors under one roof. That's interesting. And someone said that somewhere. I don't know where. Maybe it was Kiyosaki or somebody else. And so aha moment for me was like, I wanted to stop buying single family houses. I wanted to stop doing land. And flips, and I didn't do a flip, but like speculation houses and things like that.
So Travis, a question I have, like why real estate? I mean, you built this successful business, you had bought a couple properties on the way, but in most people's definition, you've already achieved success. And I know we've all been asked the question, like, hey, when's enough enough? Or, you know, why do you want 100+ units? Why do you want 500 units? Why do you want 1,000 units? So what about real estate investing? I mean, you built a successful business, you sold to private equity, you had a good payday. why continue to build? Why continue to take on this new investment and this new business of real estate investing?
You know, man, like you, I've just always loved real estate. Ever since that first house I bought, I held on to it. I squeaked it out. 5 years later, I sold it. I made $50,000. You know, there was some debt pay down. There was some, I remember thinking, there's no way in hell I could have saved $50,000 like in 5 years, making like $36,000-$40,000 a year. There's just no freaking way. And that was like, oh my gosh. And then yeah, Kiyosaki is big. I wanted passive income. Like my business was active income. I had to work for that. I had to go to work every day. I had to run a team. There was risks. There was industry changes. I was like, I want to build a portfolio of passive income, right? True passive income, to where these checks come in every single, I used to have a mindset thing. I wrote a bunch of checks to myself, like rent checks, like from like fake people, like fake tenants, but like I didn't have anything. And I would look at it and I'd be like, oh yeah, like I'd want to feel what it was like to get mailbox money. Right. And I did that. And so I was really attracted to mailbox money. It was something that I was really interested in. And again, the duplex 2008 was the only thing that paid me. Right. And so I was like, I want more of that. Like it was almost like it de-risks my position when you have a lot of units that are paying cash flow, especially spread out across the country. Like in my mind, it's like, you want one company paying you want one source of income. Everybody thinks a job's like the lowest risk. Oh, safe and secure. No, man, you're a line item on an expense sheet. And if you get deleted, right, that's one income stream. Now you have zero income. Now you got to go find another job. But if I have 700 income streams or 20 income streams or 50 income streams, like that makes me feel a lot better. And I've always sort of like it or not, I've always been like coming from nothing. I've always been looking over my shoulder, right? Like, oh, when's the next shoe going to drop? Mitch knows that about me. I make up worries sometimes, but having a lot of cash flowing real estate was really it's comforting to me. It de-risks my position, especially with housing, because housing is like a need that will never go away. Like you're not going to get offices in trouble. Like you can have SaaS companies and tech. And I was in a really high risk industry. So having housing that provided income stream it was like a nice warm blanket.
I love it. I love the passive income was important to you. I love that you wrote yourself checks from imaginary tenants. I think it's brilliant. I think it speaks to manifesting things in your life. I think it speaks to mindset. It reminds me of Jim Carrey. I may get the numbers wrong, but I believe he wrote himself $1 million check. And this was like before Dumb and Dumber, but he wrote himself $1 million blank check what was it? 10 million? Yeah. Oh, 10 million. I mean, you know, but same kind of thing. Okay. $10 million check. And it said for like acting services rendered. Right. And this is before he became big, but he believed it in his mind so much. He manifested that into his life. And it sounds like you did the same thing with real estate, with passive income.
I did the same thing with the sale of my company. Like when I had like no employees and shit was hitting the fan, and I was like, I'm someday going to sell my company for a lot of money. I don't know what it is. I just picked the number out of, you know, my hat, and I found an image of a bank account with that much money in it. And I did the same thing, and I would visualize on that. And it, funny enough, like literally like 11, 12 years later, when I sold my company, there's no way I would have known what I sold it for. It was within like $100,000.
Yeah.
Of the money I took out of the sale, which is crazy.
People underestimate mindset and just belief and manifesting things into your life. So I think it's an amazing story.
But everybody lives, I think everyone lives like you can live in the same town, but everybody, you know, or the same geography or whatever, but everybody lives different lives. And it depends on what you manifest and what you think about and what you dream about and what you visualize. Like I drive through a town, I'm going to see something different than you are. And it depends on my software and what I put in there and what I focus on. You know, like we talk about the black truck effect. I talked about, via like an article where I'm like, I bought a black truck and now all I see is black trucks. I'm like, I didn't realize everyone drives black trucks. Well, that's not true. Nothing really changed except for like my filter for the world. Same thing. Like I used to drive to my duplex and I never saw the mobile home park on the way there. I never saw the apartment building on the way there. I didn't even know they existed. And then like you change your mindset or your filter and you start to see these things. So I think manifestation is interesting because you open yourself up to that future and you start to see things. And then like you say, Gabe, it's not just the law of manifestation. It's also the law of action where you start taking action and things really start to change because now you're taking action towards that big vision.
So real estate journey. Okay. So then, I really didn't like, I'm like everybody else, right? Or probably dabbling, like, you know, had a single family here, a duplex there. I had a triple net office space there. I didn't really know what I was doing. My cash flow was pretty garbage, right? And I was like, how do people like really, really scale this real estate thing up? And I've always loved real estate. Like, I've always got a kick out of it. I've read every book that I possibly get my hands on. So I thought, but like a lot of people think when they're reading a real estate book, it's like, oh, I want to learn how to flip. I want to learn how to flip these houses. A lot of people think real estate investing is like flipping houses. No, that's a job, by the way. And that's not passive income and it's not time freedom. And so I went to this, this charity event in the Dalles, which is our small town next to us. And my wife was like, yeah, I want you to meet, this, you know, my business partner, her brother. He really wants to meet you. He's really excited to meet you. He idolizes you. He's like spent so much time studying you and learning about you.
You wouldn't believe my level of excitement. Like, I was like, I don't know who this is. I'm sorry, Travis. I hate to say it.
Yeah. Well, he was probably, because Mitch is literally like he's the same person as I am. But yeah, we went to this event and I'm like, oh my God, like this is this private school that charges way too much tuition having a fundraiser. I'm like, this is like, just like everything about it, I felt wrong about it for me anyway. And so, yeah, I met Mitch and Mitch just starts talking about, you know, like, yeah, you know, real estate investing and cap rates and this and that. And I'm like, oh my God, I've never met somebody. Cause when I was coming up, and I'm older than you guys, not by a lot, but by a little, when I was coming up, like there was no like Brandon Turner or Bigger Pockets or multifamily millions or 0 to 100. I mean, there was just like, you're trying to figure it out and you're like, go to Barnes and Noble and look for like a real estate book. And so like getting around people that are just as excited as you about accomplishing the same thing was really life changing. And yes, Mitch did change my life in a good way. We sat down, we became like best friends. And then we just from there, like we, all this stuff we're teaching on this tribe, teaching in the accelerated program, the elites and all of you, like start with your mindset, think about bigger properties. Mitch, I remember I was sitting in this very office and Mitch is like, hey, have you heard of syndication? I'm like, what the hell is syndication? Or what do you mean about raising capital? Like, wait, you can partner with people that have money, or you can be a capital provider and deals with money. Or like, I never thought in a million years I'd buy something bigger than like a threeplex or a duplex. And we went out, we were like, we had no money. All my money was getting shoveled back in the company. And Mitch and I are flying to like Milwaukee, looking at like 50 unit apartment buildings, like no idea what we're doing, but we're like listening to every Bigger Pockets podcast. We're like reading every single book that we could. We're joining masterminds. Like we're just like absorbing it and talking about it every single day. And I'm going to tell you, like getting the mindset right, thinking about partnering with people with capital, understanding like force appreciation, larger properties, 5 units or more, like that one little duplex that I bought, I was like, okay, Mitch, by the way, I need some more cash flow because I'm not paying myself a lot out of my company right now. And I had, $200,000 in equity. And I sold it, did a 1031 exchange. I was making $800 a month positive cash flow at the time of that duplex. But here's something a lot of people forget about is like, what's your cash on equity? And my cash on equity was okay. But when I started looking at these mobile home parks, I was like, oh, I could take this as a down payment on a mobile home park and partner with Mitch, who also had some money from flipping a house. And we bought this mobile home park like 2,000 miles away. And I was like, this is great. I'm going to like three to four X my cash flow on that. So you're always looking at that cash on equity. And that was that mobile home park might've been one of the most important, properties that we've ever bought because A, it showed me like it sort of highlighted cash flow and cash on equity. B, the day we closed on it, it started to go downhill. Like we hired a third party property manager. Oh, we're going to hire this property manager and they're going to manage it and everything's going to be great. We're going to high five. It's going to be passive. And then literally we had like half the park move out. There are long-term RVers and Mitch and I had to really figure it out and put get an asset manager or get our operations together. And because if you like can force yourself to learn and how to successfully operate a property that's 2,000, 3,000 miles away, that is a superpower. Now we can buy properties anywhere because we have the systems in place for it.
Travis, let's talk about that as an investment philosophy or just part of your investment strategy, the return on equity or the cash on equity, because I think probably like you and me and a lot of other investors, like when I buy something, I buy it to hold it forever. Now, it's not that I don't sell properties every once in a while, but everything I ever bought, it was to buy and hold. right? And so then years go on and you start looking at your equity position and you're going, oh my gosh, it cash flows well, especially on paper, right? But you're one CapEx, one big, you know, new roof away from blowing all your cash flow. So $800 a month, $1,000 a month, $2,000 a month. But then all of a sudden you have $250,000, $500,000 in equity. I want you to speak a little bit on that, just to your investment philosophy and strategy around, you know, at what point do you say, you know what, I have a strong equity position here. The cash flow is good. The cash flow has allowed you to hold the property up until this point, but now it's time to take that equity and put it somewhere else. Do you have any kind of metric or system that you go by or numbers you go off of like, hey, this is the time for me to sell this. This is the time for me to move this equity into a bigger and better property.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think there's a lot of answers to that, and it's very personal. For one, I didn't want to own a duplex anymore because I was dealing with hope appreciation. I hope it appreciates. I hope the house next door sells for more. And I read Multifamily Millions by David Lindall, and, you know, Mitch and I, it was one of the first books we read. And I understood, like, for every annual dollar of profit that you can create in a property, you can increase the value 10 to 20 times. I'm like, oh, that's called forced appreciation. And so I wanted to get out of a 4-unit or smaller property and get into something that was 5 units or bigger. And so that was like the number one thing. Also, like, pro forming this thing out, we're buying this park was a literal 10 cap when we bought it. So we're like, oh, 20% cash on cash, which, by the way, it has now performed true to date, 20% cash on cash. But at that, so in that case, it was like, yeah, let's get out of it. I would also say, like, sometimes properties might have decent equity and the cash flow is lower, or you're in single digit cash on cash, or you're like 8, 7, 6, 7. Cause over time, as you hold that property, yeah, the cash flow goes up, but usually if you're doing it right, the equity grows a lot faster, right? So you might have a 15% cash on cash, 14, 13, 12, you know, it goes down over time as you pay debt down. And as you raise rents and improve the net operating income, your equity is going to grow way faster than your cash flow. So that might be the time where that's when it's time to potentially harvest your cash flow, or I'm sorry, harvest your equity. But like, if you have a smaller property, Mitch and I had a small property just this last year that wasn't serving us. It was like a 25 pad mobile home park. Cash flow was crappy. We were spending more time than we wanted to on it. And it was smaller. And anytime there was like a CapEx event, it just wiped us out. And so we're like, let's just harvest, and we had some equity, and let's harvest the equity and let's use that for something else. And so it comes down to like, what sort of properties do you want to hold? What's your time commitment in those properties? What's the equity? And then what's the cash on equity that you're going to try and harvest and generate out of subsequent properties?
Well, I think I want to add that. I want to add that to that too. Like, you know, it doesn't have to be a sale. It could be a refinance. You could put responsible debt on there with a good, strong DSCR and debt hurdle and change your cash on equity equation significantly by accessing tax-free capital out of that deal. And now you have less equity and you have capital in your hands to go deploy somewhere else. And so today, like, that's part of our strategy, right? It's like you grow, we get into these assets, we force appreciate them. Your cash on cash technically, you know, goes up, but your cash on equity falls as your equity grows. We wait for, you know, the right sort of loan terms or debt environment, go access tax-free capital, take your equity stake down, increase your cash on equity and deploy that capital somewhere else. And we can do that over and over again with assets that we force appreciate. You just can't do that over and over again with a duplex because, well, it's hope appreciation, right? So, so there's also that, like, you know, you could trim the tree and sell some assets, but you could also go back to the bank and say, hey, I have a good asset I can put more debt on.
Yeah. Very well explained.
So going back a little bit, Travis, to, you know, when we met, like, I think that, like, coming from my perspective, that really changed my life too. And I was always scared to partner. I mean, you've been a great partner and I can see us partnering forever. Just because we've got this great dynamic and we work together really well. But, like, you know, when you look at your past and partnering, like, partnering feels like it's a marriage, you know, if I had to describe it, where it's like, it can go really bad or really good. Like, maybe talk about some of your partners in the past and how maybe you fell on your face and how, like, because it takes some faith to partner. It really does. And it's a little scary, but I'll tell you, once you get the right partner, for me, we talked about it, the tipping point today, like partnering with you was a tipping point for me where it was like, it tipped it in my favor. It put the odds in my favor of success. And that's been awesome. But, like, you know, can you give some recommendations on finding a good partner, maybe some lessons learned in your past?
Yeah, sure. And I don't mean to sound like a naysayer or like poo-poo, because first of all, I'll preface it with this. And we mentioned this on the Elite Call, like you go alone, you can do something quickly. You go with a team, you can go far. And I do believe in that. Like, it's why, you know, we partner with Gabe on 0-100. It's like there's definitely an immense amount of strength in partnerships, with the right kind of partnerships. Like, what are my core geniuses? What are your core geniuses? How do we work together? But I will also tell you this, and maybe I'm just speaking anecdotally here. Most partnerships don't work. Like, most business partnerships absolutely fail. And it's even more difficult. Like, I've signed more shit with Mitch than I have with my wife, right? Like, more. And so, like, partnerships can be a life changer, but they also can absolutely destroy you. And it might not just be like, maybe like the partnership on paper looks good because I'm good at this, you're good at that, I've got these analytical skills, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But then you don't share the same philosophy. Like I've had that first partner that I had when I started that first company and I didn't know what I was doing, my boss, he was a workaholic. He worked 7 days a week, 15, 16 hour days, and expected me to do the same. And I'm in my, like, I'm like 23 years old. Like, I want to live life, and I hated it. And I was miserable. Now, he was really good at his job and I was good at my job. And I was a sales, you know, I was kind of the sales guy and he was sort of like the tech guy, but it was awful because it didn't work. And then his addiction for work converted to addiction for alcohol. And then it got really ugly. So yeah, partnerships can be ugly. And I've seen it a million times. Like, I've seen a lot of partnerships fizzle out. So I would say, make sure you align philosophically. Like, Mitch and I are big on time freedom. Same with Gabe. The three of us are big on, like, we'll build 0-100 slower. Like, we talk to people, they're like, oh, you got to send out a podcast every single day and you got to do this and do that and work all these hours and you'll grow it really fast. And we're like, yeah. Or we could just kind of take our time and we can grow the 0-100 tribe at a pace that feels good for us and we can have fun doing it and it can be our passion and we can enjoy it. So Mitch is the same way. Mitch always looks at things through the lens of time. And like, there's times where I, like, this last year was tough for me. Last year, like, I was focusing on Oklahoma City. I wasn't a great business partner to Mitch, but I always knew that he had my back. And like, at some point, Mitch is going to have to duck out and he's going to have to work on stuff and I'm going to step in and fill the gap. So I would advise people, A, be very careful with partnerships. B, you also can date. Mitch says this all the time. You could date. Like, Mitch and I, like, we did a mobile home park deal together. That was our partnership. There was no Cadia Capital Group. There was no 0-100. There was nothing. And we did a deal together and the deal went south, actually, like I said, pretty quickly. Now, I could have blamed Mitch. He could have blamed me. We all know it's probably Mitch's fault anyway, but you know, I don't need to bring that up. Like, I don't need to rub that in his face, but like, it was stressful. It's like 3,000 miles away. And like, we went from 90% occupancy to 85 to 80 to 75. And we're like, oh my God, like, this is 3,000 miles away. We're in trouble. And then there was also some personal stuff outside of Mitch and I's control. Like, there was some trepidation and some turmoil outside of our relationship between other partnerships, like, with, you know, so, and Mitch and I survived and we were still best friends. We turned the deal around. We worked together. We didn't blame each other. We focused on lifestyle. We had the same goals in mind. And that was like that was a good litmus test. That was like, oh, I mean, we could throw a lot of shit at us and we can be pretty resilient through that. And so I would say, like, pick your partnerships wisely and make sure you align philosophically. Also, if you could, the one thing Mitch and I didn't do is we're like the same damn person. Like, we're visionaries and we like to put deals together, but we're not integrators, right? And so we actually brought a third integrator on. She was my ex chief operating officer from my company. She's now the CEO of Cadia, and that's going to work really, really well. But maybe if you like find someone that aligns philosophically and you guys value the same thing, and on this tribe, it should be time freedom, by the way, number one, but maybe you have different skill sets that can complement each other. That's great. But I think more importantly, it's philosophical alignment.
Travis, I love that you said that. That's actually something that I recognize. I may not have told you guys this, but one of the reasons I decided to partner on 0-100 is I recognized your guys' partnership in your business and how good of partners you were. And you spoke in ways, you spoke about time freedom, you spoke about family, you spoke about supporting each other on all the areas of life that were important outside of business. And that's something that really attracted me to you guys as humans. So great business great business guys, but also just really good, good humans. And I'm not sure if I've told you that, but I've seen a lot of partnerships where, you know, you can just tell like within minutes that it's a toxic partnership for, you know, and I've been fortunate. The majority of the partnerships I've had, have been good partnerships, but it's something that I recognized with you guys, the way that you spoke about each other, the way you guys interacted and the way you guys supported each other outside of business. And so I think it's just a quality and you're not always going to know that in a partnership right away. But, you know, I think what you said, Travis, was just gold and just, some amazing nuggets in there for people that are listening.
Yeah, well, ditto, right? I mean, Mitch and I, we were looking for a third person to come in with the 0-100 tribe, and we were looking for someone that actually lived what we're preaching, which is Gabe, which is a badass, owns like $60 million in real estate, works like an hour a week on it or whatever. I don't know. It's like crazy. This guy's like lives this amazing life. He built it from scratch, but everything's like family and lifestyle and time freedom. And so that was the same thing. That's the exact reason. Like, again, we're a partnership, but yeah, it's philosophical alignment, which I think is really important.
Yeah. I think you're with partnership, you got to be careful, because I think a lot of people get into it and it's like tit for tat. And it's like, we're asking all the time, like, oh, what roles and responsibilities does Travis have versus you and Kadia, or with 0-100, what roles and responsibilities do you guys have with? And I'm like, it's for us, it's not documented. We step up to things we're excited about. We don't hold, it's not tit for tat. If one person, you know, like I had some family stuff come up, and I'm like, I tell Gabe and Travis, Hey, I got to unplug. Whatever. They're both like, no problem at all. We got it. You took off a week, you know, 2 months ago. So I think like having the long term in mind, having each other's back, encouraging each other to live big lives outside of our business, I think is really important. I'm lucky to have that with you guys as well. So
the only thing I would change about our partnership is that you call me sir. And I've been trying to get that for a while now but anyway, we can talk about it later. We can talk it offline.
That's a weird request for on a podcast, Travis. Let's take it offline. I interrupted you, Gabe. You had something going.
No, I think I said what I was trying to say. I guess one question kind of unrelated, but I'm always curious about asking others, because I've been asked this a lot, especially lately for some reason, but I'm curious, Travis, or really Travis and Mitch. I'm curious. Do you guys think entrepreneurs are born or they're made?
Oh man, I don't know though. Like the only sort of like answer I can only generate an answer based on my own experience. Like I've always been different. I've thought differently. Like whenever, like that internship class, everybody went to the phone company when I was in high school to like file papers, cause that they were going to train themselves to be corporate America. I'm like, fuck that. I'm going to go be a DJ at a radio station. And, you know, so I've always kind of thought differently. And I've always like, when my friends were doing W-2 stuff, and I was starting companies when I didn't know what I was doing. So I don't know, man, like, I don't know if it's just because I had the mindset. And then I went down that direction. I think for me, it was like, I've always like hated mediocrity, and I've always wanted to do something different and something exceptional. But I think it starts with the mindset. I think anybody can be an entrepreneur. I think anybody can be a very successful entrepreneur. But if you don't have the right mindset, then, you know, go to the post office and get a job, right? Get your mindset right first, because damn, it's not easy. So I'd say not everybody might, but you can also like, people aren't born with a mindset. You can change your mindset. So I'd say, yeah, anybody can be an entrepreneur, but it starts with a mindset 100%. That's why it's like the number one pillar in our tribe here.
Yeah. What do you think, Mitch?
I think it's a great answer. I think I agree with Travis. I think that like, well, I'll say this. I think some people are born more inclined or more sort of like people that don't even have to try, but they gravitate toward it. Right. They just have this natural inclination for like the pain of entrepreneurialism. And I say the pain because it's really true. But at the same time, there's people that are, you know, maybe working a W-2 job that want to be an entrepreneur. Like I don't think that it's one of those things where you look in the mirror and say, well, I just wasn't born to do this. I think you can download the right software. You can download the right software. I mean, like learn the right things, surround yourself with the right people, and you'll start to see your mind change, and the way you think change, the way you perceive change. So like, yeah, I do think people are like born and they're like, they have a natural inclination for it. But then there's people that go, look, it took me a while, but I learned the ropes. I understand it. I'm ready to sign up for that adventure, that pain. And they can move into that and become really good entrepreneurs. So maybe I'll say both, which is a total terrible answer.
Yeah, no, I would say both as well. So yeah, well said.
Mitch, what's the best mindset fuel for those that are just getting started?
I mean, in this, I got to go to Rich Dad Poor Dad first, or as one of the, my top. If you haven't read Rich Dad Poor Dad, go read it. Multifamily Millions with Dave Lindahl is awesome. It's mindset, but also real estate. And I got a plug. We have a book coming out within a couple months, 0 to 100 cash flow units, which is like, it's all of it. It's mindset. It's education. It's deal flow, deal analysis. It's everything we do. We unpack our business. We get under the hood. And so there's some awesome books. The other thing, by the way, is just get involved in the tribe. We have people in this tribe, not only Tribe Gabe and I, but like other people who are scaling in real estate and can just getting around them. Like you're just soaking that in. You're changing the way you think and you don't even know it sometimes. So the other thing for mindset, if you're in the car and you're driving and you're alone, I'm always learning. I turn off the radio, turn off the BS, the news, turn off everything else and just learn. Turn your car into a university. There's a lot of hours you can log there to change your mindset. You want to scale in real estate, but you have nothing, right? You wake up. What's your next move? What are you going to go do to like make some progress in this and get back to where you are today?
I'm certainly not going to get a job because that's like death to like productivity. Like there goes 40 to 80 hours a week gone. And my mind's my time and my headspace. I'm probably going to, first of all, I'm gonna see if I can borrow some money from somebody, you know, like just to like, you know, get off the couch, maybe get a desk, buy a computer. I think right out of the gate, I would probably, I'd have two paths going at the same time. One, I would start a side hustle. I live in a town where people can make really good money here with like painting or cleaning moss off roofs, whatever. Just like there's a lot of money here. So I'd probably start something like that and ramp it up as quickly as I could. Door hangers, you know, ads on social media, all of that. And then, you know, hire a person or two to kind of get that going. Maybe it's hauling off trash or whatever, people, you know, power washing driveways as fast as I can. So I'd start a little sort of like side hustle. And then I would also get myself out of that business as fast as I could. At least maybe I'm only working a few hours a day on it and I have other people helping me. And then I would just start looking for deals. Cause that's my superpower. I've bought companies before and I've bought lots of real estate and that's been a primer driver of my success. So I would go look to buy companies, in real estate. And then I would continue to build my network. So when the time came and I found a really good deal that was going to just make me a lot of money and make my investors a lot of money, I'd have the capital lined up and pull the trigger.
It's amazing.
Awesome. Great answer. I love how he talks about the very first thing. He goes, not get a job because it's going to take away my time. And we know time is the most important asset we have. So that was phenomenal. Gabe, you want to take the last one or you want me to take it?
I do not want to ask the question that I think you're going to ask.
Gabe's like, you got it. All right. Last question, which this sucks because I got to go up against Gabe and Gabe's a beautiful person. Who is the best looking between Gabe and I?
Hands down, Gabe.
Come easy. On, man. You didn't even think about it. There's just easy. Not even a thought.
Easy.
Unbelievable. I thought about all asking right. just like a completely different question. Like Travis, yeah. If you had to take one of us on a first date that included dinner and ballroom dancing or right. something, but
right. Well, I've already after done all that this with time Mitch we spend times. Together though, it's like, I can't yeah. believe you just picked Gabe that quick. It wasn't even
well, I've done a lot of ballroom dancing and dinners with Mitch. So I'd want to see what Gabe had to offer.
So you'd also take Gabe. So Gabe takes two out of two.
Right. But also like Gabe's he's a vegan and he's a badass vegan and I'm trying to like eat a lot cleaner yeah. and either go down that road. So you like when I hang out with you, you just like, let's get steak and beer.
Gabe's you know what? People like my flavor. All right. So at some point someone's going to be hands down for me. So I'm just going to wait for that.
We did go on like three back-to-back vegan dinner dates, Travis, in Oklahoma. So that
good for
that
you
counts
guys.
For something.
Good for you. I wasn't invited.
Right. Well, yeah, you don't want to be an owner. I got a comment from Chris. Oh my gosh. Thank you for saying that. Travis, not going to get a job. I lost mine and I've been struggling to get another one. Still wondering if that is the right thing, given my interest in real estate. I mean, it's a personal decision for sure, but I just know that like, that's what I would do. in with my history, you know, or maybe like get a full commission sales job. Like that's interesting. Like maybe get, I'm always looking at ways, like how do you outsize your income? Right. And I tell like high school kids out of college, get a commission job that doesn't have a cap on it, where I can go maybe get a draw and I could go sell something and make good money.
And you control your time too.
Right.
Right.
Your full commission, they can't ask you to clock in, clock out.
Well, the other piece, the more you start earning, people forget this, the more you start earning, the harder it is to replace that income. So the quicker you can get to R1, the quicker you can replace your income, the more time you have to go start investing, start looking at deals, start creating some passive income. You start building up a large income, that's going to be harder to replace. It's doable, but it's just more income that you have to replace.
But it's also terrifying. Like if I was laying on that couch and I didn't have any of the knowledge that I had, I didn't have the network that I had, right? And I didn't understand how to create and unlock value in real estate and companies. Like, hell yeah, a lot of people go get a job because they don't know what else to do. But you can arm yourself with education. You can arm yourself with a network. You can start engaging in this platform. You can start learning deals. And then with that, like nobody can take that from you. And that's why I wouldn't get a job, because I'm better. My skills are better. I'm better like marrying capital with value, you know, in deals. That's what I do.
I love that. That's an amazing answer. Thank you so much for joining.
Appreciate you listening to me ramble on. It's fun.